So this is the first day of this four-day retreat. In which we are continuing our study and practice of these 7 points of mind training. Last fall, we had an intensive on the mind trainings that ended in December. How many people were in that? So many of you are familiar. And then last fall, we had a retreat on these slogans, mind trainings. How many people were at that? Oh, good. And how many people have had an opportunity to listen to the talks from last? Everybody but Brian. Doesn't look good, Brian. You may have to stay after class on this one. So good. So that means mostly everybody has a general familiarity with these precious teachings. And have not only received the commentaries that I made during the intensives and the retreat, but also have they had opportunity to hearing from great masters such as Jamyang Kangtro, one of our texts, The Great Path of Awakening, and other commentaries by traditional and modern teachers, all to elucidate the way of practice. For those of you who were perhaps looking forward to moving on, learning new ones in this intensive, and looking it over in preparation, I realized that would be shortchanging you. In looking over the slogans, especially the early ones, in a certain sense the most important, I realize I need to continue to study and practice them. So I hope you will indulge me over these next 4 days as we continue to look and relook at these most profound, because the genius of these slogans, these 59 points of training the mind, is they really encapsulate the path of the Bodhisattva. There is very, really, there is nothing outside of this that we need to attend to. All are variations on a theme, and in these slogans, the theme of awakening and to living the life of a Bodhisattva is so clearly and succinctly and directly presented to us that it is simply our job to deepen our understanding, that our understanding goes under this and becomes this. That is what practice does. Reading, studying, talking about does not give us this. This only comes from a deep willingness to engage openly, sincerely, to be like an empty vessel, to be like a hungry person, to be like a thirsty person. Someone who's thirsty, they only want water. Right? Somebody who's hungry, they only want food. Somebody who is sick only wants medicine. All the other things become all the things you usually wanted in life, right? When you're incredibly thirsty, have been reduced to water, food, medicine, right? And all the other concerns and needs and wants take a very backseat to it. So it is in this manner that we really should approach the teachings. And in this manner, even this Dharma talk, we should approach in that same mind state. We should be alert. We should be awake. What if we're not awake? We're not alert, right? Maybe we're sleepy. Well, maybe we should get up and bang our head against the wall. Maybe we should go out beforehand and throw cold water on our face or go outside and run around. Why would one do that? Because one wants to be present. Not for Fred. Fred is a very imperfect vehicle. But the Dharma that has the power to free us from all our sufferings, from all our afflictions, from all our narrowness and pettiness, and to open us up to a way of life that is transformative and meaningful, it is for the Dharma, not for Fred, that one wants to be awake and have this kind of thirsty mind that just drinks it all in. Right? It is said in the tradition that one practices the Dharma like one's hair on fire. You've heard that expression. Again, that doesn't mean that's not the... That doesn't mean the pain is so intense, you know. It means that when one's hair is on fire, one only has one thought, which is simply to put it out. Everything else, again, takes the back seat. I want to put the fire out, right? We want to put out the fire of our egoisms, our self-centeredness, our self-preoccupation, our self-absorption, this endless, endless, endless preoccupation with ourselves, right? Which we think, right, in our delusion that somehow, you know, if I meet all the needs and wants of myself, then I will be what? Happy. This fundamental fallacy that we just work and work and work and work at, and it will never give us. It cannot give us what we seek. But Dharma can. A Dharma can, because it is 2,600 years of people just looking at this very fundamental issue from the Buddha on right till today. Right? Of what, you know, what produces meaning and happiness and joy and goodness in the individual and in society. And the answer has been proclaimed quite loudly for thousands of years. So we've come here on retreat. And as I said last night, it is often hard for us, even though we know as lay people our practice is our daily life. Daily life is our practice. Daily life is where we... is the only place where realization manifests in a real way, and we know we know where we're at. We cannot fool ourselves in daily life, right? We can hide away. We can hide away on our meditation cushion, and we can hide away in our books, our Dharma books, and we can even hide away on retreat. But daily life, relationships, interactions will show us where we're at. But having said that, the learning process, the introspective process, the reflective process, the meditative process is much, much more easily accomplished in retreat, right? Because it's very hard in the midst of hustle and bustle and activity of daily life the opportunities we often have to really contemplate and reflect are limited, to really make a significant shift in direction. So that is why the capacity to step back from that world of activity, the world of drama, and to just put it all down. Let's do that again. And just to put it all down. Is that clear? Put it all down. And don't pick it back up. The concerns, the ups and downs of our daily life, where do they get us? If we're really, you know, if we step back, where do they get us? In terms of what we really want in life. So we put them down so we can take out, right, those things which really have the capacity to free us and that are deserving of our attention, right? Usually we give our attention what? To the petty. To the petty. The petty concerns of the self. The petty everyday concerns of life. Well, that's just life, the full catastrophe. But, you know, if we are to be objective, we would have to say, you know, it's a lot of it's pretty petty. If we really were to, if we really, each of us, were to attach a loudspeaker to our mind and let everybody in on the internal dialogue that goes on from morning to night, we would run and hide. We would be embarrassed, wouldn't we? By what in the privacy of our own minds concerns us, what we think about, what we talk about with ourselves. That is why we need this altruistic aspiration that this text, these teachings give us. So, hopefully everyone last night, I said, the object of our first evening and morning together is to arrive. Hopefully everyone has arrived. You know that you are here on retreat and you are somewhat settled in yourself. Again, on retreat, as should be most of the time, we talk about having an inner life, right? An inner life has to do with what's going on in the mind. That's the inner, right? This is the outer. The so-called external world. In truth, it's not like that. But in the world of appearances, we talk about an inner and an outer. An outer and an inner. And the inner life of ours is the world of thoughts, feelings, perceptions, ideas, memories, awareness, mindfulness, mind states. This is our inner life, right? This is our inner life, which again can be seen by others, but that only we really have the opportunity to really see clearly. Right? So in retreat, what we are most concerned is our inner life, right? That is why we maintain silence. That is why we dispense with much of the interactions and relationships that occupy us during life. And then we don't have anything really to do, do we? So we can be focused on our inner life, our thoughts, our feelings, our perceptions, how we are relating to the moment, not what's going on in the moment. So if you're still looking around, if you're still concerned about what everybody else is doing, please stop. There's only one person you need to be concerned about here. That is yourself. Please set that right from the beginning. There's only one person you need to keep an eye on. There's only one person you need to attend to. And that's yourself. When we talk about yourself, we're talking about that inner thoughts, feelings, perceptions, dialogue, memories, imagination. That's what we are doing. Is that clear? That is the only way of developing self-knowledge. As the Zen Master Dogen says, the study of Buddhism is the study of self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. It's a process. But it doesn't, it has to do with a willingness to look directly at what is called within. And for many of us, that is very new. We are an externally driven people. Right? We are people who are always looking outside, and we are people who always are thinking that our happiness, meaning, fulfillment is always based on getting something outside ourselves, right? We are also people who think that the source of all our problems is external to us. But that is not true. The source of our happiness, the source of our suffering is our own minds and nowhere else. This is fundamental to Buddhist teaching, to Buddhist outlook. So during these 4 days, please do not waste the time. Again, you know, don't look around. Somebody comes into Dharma Hall, look at this, look at it. What are we looking at? Don't think about the food. Whatever the food is, eat it. And hopefully you'll enjoy it. I mean, it's like, right? As my grandmother used to say, there are people starving in China. Finish your plate. Right? I mean, and it's still true. Right? So, no matter what they serve us, we are among the privileged. We should always remember that and eat in gratitude. So, those of you who've listened to the Dharma talks from the last retreat, you are ahead of me since I have no idea what was said. So forgive me if I repeat myself. So we are reading from this text called The Great Path of Awakening. It is a very brief commentary on these 59 slogans by a great, and you know, I mean, Atisha is a century Chikawa, the purported author, well, not purported, the author of these slogans is more like 11th century, and Jamyan Cultural is really the end of the 19th century. He lived up to 1899. He was a modern, more or less modern Tibetan teacher. And there are many, 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 many different types of commentaries on this fundamental text. But this one is by Jamyan Cultural. And he begins with a prayer, very traditional, before he begins his commentary. He says, "With undivided faith, I place upon my head the lotus feet of the perfect sage. Listen to his language. I mean, he talks this way. Do we talk this way? With undivided faith or confidence, I place upon my head the lotus feet of the perfect sage, the Buddha. Again, in Tibetan society, the head was the highest place, right? The feet are what? The lowest, right? So those of you who are pointing your feet in this way, please never do it in front of an Asian Buddhist. It is considered, I'm okay. But it would be like, oof, because the feet are considered low, dirty. You would never point your feet in the direction of a teacher or the Buddha or anything. So he says, with undivided faith, I place upon my head the feet of the Buddha. So even my highest point is below the feet, the dirtiest part of the Buddha, who first set in motion the wheel of love. So for those of you who think, oh, Buddhism is just a kind of this philosophical wisdom tradition, meditation tradition, look what Jamyang Khonchu says, who first set in motion the wheel of love. That's what he's calling the Dharma wheel, the wheel of love. And triumph completely in the two aims. The two aims are liberating oneself and liberating all beings. And then he bows to the sons and daughters, the bodhisattvas, who set out in the ship of courageous compassion. You see, I mean, these are all teachings. They're not just poetry, right? Courageous, this is the ship that bodhisattvas set out on, right? The ship of courageous compassion. It has no fear. It's not afraid of suffering. It's not afraid of suffering beings. It's not afraid of adverse situations or conditions or obstacles or challenge, right? You know. So, set out on the ship of courageous compassion. And now liberate beings from the ocean of samsara, the ocean of birth and death. The spiritual friend unsurpassable reveals a noble path of compassion and emptiness. He or she is the guide of all victorious ones. I prostrate myself at my teacher's feet. I shall explain here the one path on which the victorious one and his children have traveled. Easy to understand, it is not corrupted. Easy to practice, it is entered with enthusiasm. Yet it is profound, so Buddhahood is attained. So he's making a plug for Dharma. So, you know, this, and this text he's about to teach, you know, everybody can get this. This is easy to understand. It's just about life. It's about the mind. It's about experience. And it's not corrupt. It is pure. It's easy to practice if it is entered with enthusiasm. Yet it is profound because it leads to awakening, to Buddhahood. The next chapter goes into the source of the transmission, all the various teachers. And then the third chapter, this is before he gets to the text, is called The Need for Mind Training. He begins by saying, don't even consider the ephemeral happiness that results from birth in the higher realms of gods and men. Right? You get it? All the type of happinesses that this world holds out in terms of money, luxury, and fame, and, you know, vacation, to beautiful spots, soft sheets, all those kinds of things, all that ephemeral happiness. He says, don't even consider it. He cuts us right out. Don't even bother yourself with that stuff. Then he goes on, we should strive only for the state of completely perfected Buddhahood. Now again, this may sound to many of us here unbelievable. We sit here with our confused minds, most of the time, 95% of our time, devoting ourselves to achieving the ephemeral happiness. Right? And he says to us, right now, don't even consider that. Set your sights on Buddhahood. I wonder what each of you are saying to yourself right now, that inner dialogue. How many of you are discounting those words? He's saying it to us. Right. Not only is this the most meaningful way to live, but if you want to help the world, this is the best way to help it. This is what the world needs. I mean, the world needs many things. But at its deepest level, it needs enlightened people, awakened people. Because at this point, it is ruled, it is dominated in all areas of its life, political, social, economic, you know, pop culture, it is dominated by what? The unenlightened. Who are diligently, enthusiastically, single-pointedly leading the charge, aren't they? And trying to get everybody to get on board, using every means at their disposal to get everybody on board. For a future that is self-destructing in their very face. And yet, still rally us on. This world needs enlightened beings, it needs enlightened leadership, and that can only come out of people who walk this path. I mean, not only this path, like, but, you know, a deeply spiritual awakening path. Since Buddhism is a teaching based on cause and effect, and that is the kind of science of Buddhism. Because it is said that every seed has the potential of the whole plant. Right? Every seed has the potential, I mean, all these big oaks, these big marvelous trees, all come from what? Seed. That's what each one of them began. In truth, each of us began with a seed. Right. So, to plant the seed of the aspiration to become a Buddha in your heart mind now, if you nurture it diligently, vigilantly, continually, continuously, enthusiastically throughout your life, it can do nothing but grow. All Buddhas, all bodhisattvas are the product of this seed, right? This aspiration to become a Buddha, to become enlightened. There is nothing else but that they cultivated at the deepest level. And that is what has sustained them from the beginning, when it was just a tiny seed, right? A lotus seed in the mud. That is the only thing that has sustained them and that were the causes for the lotus to grow. Consequently, we should strive for the state, only for the state of completely perfect Buddhahood. There are no methods to effect this attainment other than those which rely on two forms of meditation. Relative bodhicitta, which is training the mind in love and compassion, and ultimate bodhicitta, which is resting evenly in a non-discursive state, free from conceptual elaborations. Okay, so here he's setting it out. These, if we just want to make it very simple, what is this path about? Two things. The cultivation of what's called relative bodhicitta, right? The awakened mind of love and compassion, and the awakened mind of wisdom or insight, right, which understands the absolute true nature of the mind, right? When you put these together, what do you have? A Buddha. When it's fully manifested. He quotes Nargarjuna, the great Nargarjuna, the great king of the Madhyamika in India, the great Buddhist teacher. He says, if the rest of humanity and I wish to attain unsurpassable awakening, the basis for this is bodhicitta, as stable as the king of mountains. Compassion, which touches everything, and pristine wisdom, which does not rely on duality. This is a little quote. So this whole text, these 59 slogans, are about just this, right? It's about how to realize what is called this absolute bodhicitta, this absolute unconditioned aspect of our own minds. It's not somebody else's mind, of our own mind, and how to cultivate this unceasing, non-referential love, compassion for all beings. As it says here, compassion which touches everything. Isn't that a great line? Right. Compassion which touches everything. Not a compassion that only touches some things. Not a compassion that has an on and off switch. A compassion that is always alive. It is the basis for how to be in the world. Goes on to say that all the practices and everything they're simply based on the arousal of this enlightened mind, which arises on the basis of love and compassion. Again, as you all know, it is not just our own suffering that is motivating us. If our practice, even though most people begin their Dharma practice from a worldly point of view, which means the worldly ego is suffering, right? Is unhappy, can't seem to get it right, right? This is what often brings us to Dharma, right? The Buddha understands that, understood that, right? But it will not keep us there. Right? Because when things turn, things get a little better, a little less stressful, better relationship, better job, you know what I mean? All of a sudden, that enthusiasm for awakening, you'll notice. And many people will notice. Even though many people have practiced for years and years, that it waxes and wanes, right? It comes and it goes. Sometimes we're enthusiastic, sometimes we're not enthusiastic. Sometimes we're interested, sometimes our practice is almost like a burden to us. a responsibility, a duty, something we do because we know it's good for us, but there's a, you know, we'd rather be out doing something else, watching Netflix or something. The only thing that will sustain a practice that begins, even no matter how dark we are, that will bring us to full Buddhahood is not our own suffering, even though that's a contributory cause. It is a desire because of our love for sentient beings, our identification with suffering beings, our empathy for their suffering, with that desire to free them from their suffering. That will sustain us, because that is constant. The sufferings of sentient beings are endless, right? And even as they're exiting on one side of life, they're coming in on the other side, right? Birth and death. The bowl of human suffering is never ending, right? Because it's always being filled up. It's like on my pool. It's always, you know, full. Because there's a thing called a pool leveler that's attached to a hose, that, right? So that every time it begins to go down, there's a little float, it lets in water. Right? So the pool is always full. This world of suffering is always full, because as soon as people exit, when they die, beings are constantly being born, and they just continue in the same way. Is that clear? So the vow to liberate beings from their suffering is an endless vow. And because the path to Buddhahood is an endless path, it is only that intention in our own hearts. You know, may I awaken to in order to be of benefit to beings. That will sustain us. That will overcome our laziness. That will overcome our indecision. You know, that will overcome all the obstacles. Because we know that oftentimes an external force will have more power over us to motivate us than internal. Right? We all know that. So until Buddhahood is attained, we need something until it becomes so natural, so spontaneous in our hearts, minds, we need that thought, that intention to work for the benefit of beings. What is the best way that I can work for the benefit of beings is to free myself from my own delusions, my own pettiness, my own narrowness, to open my heart to the practices that open it. Even when full Buddhahood is attained, there is nothing to do except to work for the welfare of others with non-referential compassion. And then he says something very interesting. Please understand, we haven't even gotten to the text yet. So I don't know if I'm doing better or worse than last time. He says, true ultimate bodhicitta will not arise in the course of the experience of beginners. But relative bodhicitta will definitely arise if they train in it. With the development of relative bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta will be realized naturally. So this is very important to get. So what is he saying? He's saying that the capacity really to understand the nature of mind, to rest deeply in the very nature of mind, deeper than the world of conceptualization of duality, to really penetrate to those depths of one's own mind, and is more advanced, right? It's often very difficult for beginners to have that kind of experience. But he says, but the relative bodhicitta, the capacity to generate loving kindness, the capacity to generate compassion, and as in this text, the capacity to do the exchange, right? The alchemical exchange of giving away all our good and taking in all the suffering, that practice, that is available to beginners. Is that clear? That is easily done and accessible even to beginners. Right? But then he says, which is the key thing, with the development of relative bodhicitta, ultimate bodhicitta will be realized naturally. All the great masters have said that. Because if you think about it, excuse me while I blow my nose, forgive me. See, if you think about it, this shell of delusion, the shell of duality, the shell of ignorance, it is fundamentally maintained by self-absorption, right? I mean, self-absorption is a word, but what it means is that what I am concerned about all day is me, right? Even when I'm, supposedly doing good for others, it's really always about me. Right? Look how good I am. Look how compassionate I am. Look how kind I am. What a good friend. What a good father. What a good mother. What a good son. You see what I'm saying? The self is always, even in our good actions, is always taking credit. Right? As well as, it's more obvious thing where it's always has needs and wants and desires, and always in every situation is always grabbing and grasping and attaching and averting, right? So that whole universe of self-absorption as it manifests all day is offset when we let go of that, right? And push the mind. Push our actions, push our thoughts to connect with others, to be concerned by others' needs, others' wants, to have the desire to make others happy, right? And that kind of shift in mind softens the self. It makes it not as hard. The covering is not as thick. It gets softer. It gets more pliable. A little bit of osmosis, It's now a membrane. Things can get through. And that will make it easier when we are more deeply looking into the nature of our mind in doing those kinds of meditations. There's less clinging, there's less hardness in our minds, and it makes it easier to come to this type of understanding, the understanding of non-self, because through the practices, the relative practices of non-self, we have already kind of turned over the soil a bit. Is that clear? So he's saying these are not like separate tracks. Right? They feed each other. And the practices of love and compassion and all the patience and on generosity and all these paramitas, again, work the soil that make it easier to break into the world of non-duality. Because the world of non-duality, the world of our true nature, is here. But it is covered over by our delusions, and our primary delusion is this fundamental belief in identification with self and other. So the actual working through that in real life makes it easier to experience that in a meditative way. Does everybody get that? That's what's being said. And vice versa, the deeper our meditative experience of breaking through in a meditative way, the coverings of duality and self and I, me, mind, and having a greater intimacy or insight into who and what we really are, obviously softens us. It connects us. And it makes that which was more of a practice to do, right? Like, what am I working on? I'm practicing love and compassion. That's my practice. You see, I'm working at it. I'm working at it because it doesn't come naturally, right? Why do you have to practice, Diana? It doesn't come naturally. You just can't sit down and do it, right? You got to practice it. But at a certain point, you don't have to practice as hard, do you? It's more natural. So it's the same way. In the beginning, kind of, we have, right, Alex? What could my partner be thinking? Wonder what she's going, you know, right? To get us out of our self-absorption. In the beginning, it's work, right, Helena? But over time, you know, over time, over practice, it becomes easier because not only are we doing the practice more, but we're seeing the results of it. You know what I mean? It feels better. So there's a feedback loop, right? There's a softening, which makes it then easier to just keep going in the deepening, right? And so this is in the same way, you know, again, developing a selfless attitude, putting others ahead of ourself, you know. In the beginning, it's, you know, it's like, oh, blew it again, you know, kind of thing. But over time, it will become more natural. And as your meditative practice deepens, it will reinforce it. So he says, for these and many similar reasons, we must meditate energetically on relative bodhicitta at the beginning if we are to achieve any meaningful results with respect to bodhicitta. For someone who wishes instruction on this subject, the basic method for training is the Shantideva, a century, path of the Bodhisattva, says, he or she who desires shelter quickly for themselves and for all others should use this sacred mystery, the exchanging of oneself for others. So we have it on expert advice. He's quoting the experts here. If you want shelter from what? Shelter from suffering from affliction, suffering from all the, you know, the delusions that run rampant in our mind. If you want shelter, when there's shelter, what? We're in shelter, right? It's rainy outside. We're in shelter. We're not wet, are we? See, we're sheltered from the elements in here. They can't get to us, even though out there it's raining, right? The animals don't have shelter. They're huddled up. Cold, they're going to shiver. They get wet and cold. But we have shelter. It's good fortune, right, to have shelter from the elements. We want to be sheltered from the world of delusive emotions, afflictive emotions, afflictive mind states. Afflictive way of thinking. Right. quickly, he says. Use the sacred mystery, exchanging of oneself and others. And therefore, that is his... He said, this is what I'll be talking about in this text. And he says, all the other methods of mind training in Buddhism are elaborations on this one theme. So we have a little time to get into it. Any questions on what has been shared so far, or anything not quite makes sense, or you got another take on it? Or... Yes. The alchemical. Yeah, yeah. I'm not a chemist. The alchemical, which is a word meaning it's, there's a mystery to it. You know, it's like you put this and this together and something else, right, that wasn't so related to the substances occurs. Like the alchemists were always what? They were taking all these substances and creating gold. Right? But here we are, we're doing the same thing. It is an alchemical process where you bring this together and that together, you put it all together in this body-mind, and you end up with a Buddha. That's why it's called an alchemical process, because you look, I mean, you look around this room and you go, wow, right? I mean, forgive me, I'm also including myself, you know, it's like, you know, Buddhahood is going to come out of this group? And yet, we are told it is an alchemical process. You take a bunch of people like us with all our defilements and our delusions, right? And you just add in enough of the right ingredients, and magically what? We end up with bodhisattvas, with Buddhas. Is that clear? That's the alchemical transformation that is promised, right? It's again, you know, the mud in the lotus. You look at the mud, the muck, you go, a lotus? Never. Maybe some kind of ugly swamp plant, you know. Not a beautiful, you know what I mean? You, if you ever go in the swamp, you know, right? We live in close to Southwest Florida, we know about swamps. But if you go in a swamp, you don't come across a lot of flowering plants. Right? When you do, it's quite wonderful. Yeah. So any questions? Yeah, it's all pretty clear. Now we begin the actual text. And again, as you all know by now, there are 7 points. This is called the 7-point mind training. The preliminaries, which teach the support for Dharma, the actual practice of training bodhicitta, the transformation of adverse conditions into the path of awakening, the utilization of one's practice in one's whole life, the extent of proficiency in mind training, commitments of mind training, and guidelines of mind training. Most of the heavy lifting is in the early parts that we're going to focus on. Right. Much of the remainder is really kind of, I mean, they're all wonderful, but really about how to do it in daily life, right? How to do it in daily life, which is why these slogans are so wonderful and why they've been practiced for centuries and traditionally memorized, because it's just like, oh, you're just going to have these very wise, pithy little aphorisms that, you know, no matter what you run into, no matter what situation you run into, every situation can use one of these aphorisms to immediately transform it into an opportunity for awakening, for generating compassion, for deepening understanding, et cetera, et cetera. Right? But it's these earlier ones which are really more meditative based. And that is why, since we are on a meditation retreat, we have pulled back from the world. We will focus on those, even though in the upcoming intensive, we'll be spending more time on the sequential ones. So, as everybody knows, let's see if Brian can redeem himself. The first slogan is... Hey, nobody help him. Wow. I called on Brian. The first one is what?
Train in the preliminaries.
First, train in the preliminaries. Exactly. See? You have to have faith in your brother. He'll come through. Right. Now again, I will say it now, and will say it forever to the end of time. You will know that you no longer have to train in the preliminaries when afflictive emotions no longer arise. Okay? It's as simple as that. Right? They're only preliminary in a kind of time-ordered sense, which says, you know, look at these first. And we'll talk in a moment why to look at these first. But these are things to be contemplated and recontemplated over and over and over again. They are essential. If you wonder, if you've come to... you know, other retreats that have we've had, or gone to Zen or Dzogchen type of retreats that deal with the nature of mind, etc., and you wonder, you know, why can't I live it? Right? Why, you know, I kind of go to these retreats, I kind of get it, you know, but I'm hopeless. No, you're not hopeless. You just haven't practiced the preliminaries. Because the preliminaries are there, you know, as we've, if you know many times, but I'll say it again, they are called the mind turnings. They turn our mind. What is our mind? This very thing that's listening to this talk. That is your mind. It turns it in a direction that will produce meaning, happiness, purpose for you, and will turn you away from a life of affliction and meaninglessness, etc. There's got to be that turning. See, when it's a complete turn, and you're really walking in the direction you want, then it's kind of easy, right? But for most of us, it's like, turn, right? Turn to Dharma, turn to the world, turn to the, you know, it's like that, right? We never make the turn. Right? We're always, this is us. And that will not get us to where we want to go, because we'll always be like this, right? Well, we sort of, going in that direction, then head will turn. Going back. Yeah. Oh, where am I supposed? Oh, yeah. Up. So, you know. So that is why this reflection on the preliminaries is to turn us so we don't turn back. Is that clear? And so they are to be deeply reflected on, not like catechism. We are in a church, I understand, a Catholic facility, but this is not catechism. This is something to deeply encounter, to be challenged by, to question, right? So that it becomes very real and true to you. Right? You know, I remember when I had talks with our dear departed brother, Bill Menza, who many of you know, who died last year. I mean, you know, it was like, oh, it's like, as he said, you know, I've been doing the five remembrances, as everybody did this morning, for years and years and years. Loved it. Talked about it. Couldn't shut me up about it. And then I got stage 4 cancer. And I realized it was true. Like, oh, it wasn't just a teaching, you know what I'm saying? It was like, wow, it's real. Yeah. We don't know what's going to happen next, do we? We can make all the plans in the world we want for ourselves and everyone else, and yet life unfolds in reality, doesn't it? In reality, we don't know how it's going to unfold. And sickness, old age, and death is real. Right? I was just speaking to somebody a couple of weeks ago who has cancer. Same exact thing. Practitioner, you know, thought about, talked about impermanence. And then this happened. Whoa. He said, I realized in my delusion, I thought this happened to everybody but me. Right? Right? You know, I understand, you know, people get cancer, people get diseases, people get all kinds of debilitating things, you know. I understand that. But it somehow I never connected that with me and my life. And that somehow this could happen to me. Right? That I'd be the one in the hospital. That I'd be the one getting treatment. That I'd, you know what I'm saying? Like, oh, God, this is happening to me. He said, now it's real. Now I get it. Well, now he gets, I'm not going to be around forever. See, it was real to him. Before, it was all up here. Right? That's why I say the preliminaries have to be deeply encountered. You see, we got to chew on them. We got to really see what they're saying, and we got to apply it to ourselves, and to say, is it true? Right? Thich Nhat Hanh says, you know, is it true? Well, I would say with these preliminaries, we have to, you know, is it true? I'd rather not hear it, right? I mean, right? We'd rather live forever, wouldn't we? Of course, that's only if things are going well. But, you know, if things are going well, we'd like to live forever, right? Wouldn't we? We'd like never to age and stay youthful, wouldn't we? Yeah, we'd like never to be sick. Yeah, right? And yet, the truth is what? We would like never to be separated from our loved ones, would we? Never. We'd like everybody we love to live forever. But that's a fantasy, isn't it? And Dharma is not about bumming us out. It's not a downer. It's just cold water in the face. So to wake us up. So in the midst of this groundless, impermanent, unknowing world, we can live serenely, happily, with confidence, with clarity, right? Right in the midst of it. We don't need to run away. We don't need to hide. We don't need to numb ourselves. As you remember, in the beginning, he says, he breaks preliminaries down to two things. One is preliminary to a period of meditation. And here, I think I can't remember now whether I mentioned this last retreat or when I've taught this in the past, I never would mention this. See, this is about, you know, visualizing your teacher above your head. It is something that I practice when I practice with a Tibetan teacher, and is very common in that lineage. In Zen lineage, even though one, there is a direct transmission with the teacher, the style is very different. So I would always skip over this, right? I would never teach it. And I think the first time, many years ago when I taught this, I told people, some things like that are just in the Vajrayana. You don't have to pay any attention to it, you know. But this time, I forgot to say that, right? I forgot to say that to people in the intensive. And then on the first calls, I'm hearing people saying, wow, that's really great. You know, I said, since I've been doing that, you know, my meditation. So I kind of backed off to say, if it is beneficial, do it. But again, what is the reason? I think there are many reasons for it, none of which has to do to the glorification of the teacher. Okay, it has to do with us as practitioners from this side. We need all the help we can get to get us out of our lethargy, right? To get us out of our habit energy, to get us out of our conditioning, to get us out of our doing things the way we've always done things, right? We all need help in those areas. So, to have in our mind some person, living or dead, and even my Tibetan teachers would say, it says here, visualize your root teacher, but you can do it in the form of the Buddha or this one, or Valakteshvara, it doesn't matter. But it's to have with us on the cushion something that is inspiring, something that reminds us, and something that connects us to the tradition, right back to the Buddha. So you feel, even if you're sitting here at the Franciscan Center or wherever you are, that what you are doing is really a direct transmission through your teacher, his teacher, teachers, 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 going back to the Buddha. That's a very inspiring and confidence-building kind of realization. Can you see that? So there are many good reasons to do that, but only if you're comfortable with it. As well as, I think, to take a few moments at the beginning of your meditation to do something like that, to connect with the lineage and the transmission and the Buddhas and teachers, it will create a transition from our worldly mind into the world of practice. Right? Oftentimes, we got our worldly mind going, and then we go practice, sit down and meditate, and we wonder why it just keeps going. Right? We need some kind of interruption. Right? Something to put what we're doing in a different context. Does that make sense? So that's another reason to kind of do something like that. Is that clear? That is another reason why traditionally in Vajrayana Buddhism, these four contemplations are done kind of every day. It could be just very briefly, right? Recalling the preciousness of human life and the opportunities that one has. Recalling impermanence is rampant in this world and death could come at any moment. Recalling the suffering of human existence, unsatisfactoriness of all worldly pursuits, and the law of cause and effect. Right? Just to kind of put our meditation in a context, our life in a context. Is that clear? But as well, these preliminaries can be gone into very deeply. They can be the subject matter of one's meditation. They are what are called analytical meditation. So they're done with the same kind of mindfulness and concentration as we might say, just breath meditation, except they are using our capacity of our mind to understand things. Because it is our mind not understanding things which gets us in trouble. Right? As I've said many times, the fish does not understand that that bait that looks so delectable has a hook in it. Right? If it was just working on impulse, it would what? Before it knew it, it'd be up on somebody's boat. Right? But if it had some capacity to stop and to look more deeply, right? Might see the hook, might see the line, might decide to just let it go, keep on swimming. Right. So this is a very important part of our training early on. Today we will spend time once again. We will spend time once again until we get it. And again, as I said earlier, we will know we get it because we're no longer interested in food that have hooks. We are still too interested. We are still seduced. Attracted to things that look outwardly pleasurable but have hooks in them. Is that clear? So, we need to look very deeply into these areas of life so we get it. When we get it, we will no longer be fooled. And when we are now putting our energies into things that can really produce for us a quality of life that we seek, that will reinforce the kind of... these are called... when we talk about the worldly pleasures, it is not denying that they do not give worldly pleasure. And it does not deny that they do not provide, when they work for us, worldly happiness, right? Buddhism doesn't deny that. But it is always a happiness that is conditional, right? Right. So this morning I woke up and my nose wasn't full like it had been for days and my head was a little clearer. And you know what? I was happy. Right? I was happy. But that was a conditional happiness, right? Can you see that? Because it was based on something kind of going my way. Right? And that will not last. Right? I mean, that happiness from not having a stuffed nose and a clear head, is not lasting all day. Right? It's conditional on that moment of seeing. And I'd have to keep repeating it over and over again, which you get a little tiresome after a while. On the other hand, because that conditional happiness of having a clear nose and a clearer head has in it already the seeds of its opposite. You see what's happening since I started talking to you today? And if you don't think, I'm not disappointed. I was hoping this one was totally behind me, right? But here it is, right? Up and down, back and forth. It doesn't mean we don't participate in this conditional world, but we're not fooled by it. We understand this is the way it is. Sometimes it's like this, sometimes it's like that. It's not a big deal. The preciousness of human life. many people have the opportunity to believe that they have a good life, don't they? But again, usually that is based on things are working for them. Right? They get good health, or they get good relationships, or a good family, or a good job, or a nice house, or you know what I mean? So oftentimes, many people can be grateful, right, for their life. But this is not about that, is it? When the Buddha talks about this preciousness of human life, it's about time and opportunities. To have this precious, again, it's really not called the precious human life. It's called, it's a specific kind of life that is rare, that is precious. Is that clear? So sometimes people think precious human life talking about all life. In a certain sense, I mean, Buddhism says to be a human being offers opportunities just to be a born a human being that animals or other kinds of realms don't have. But more specifically, when we talk about this rare, precious birth, it means that there is time and opportunities to do something meaningful with one's life. One has the time to meditate. One has the time to go to retreat. One has the time to go listen to teachers and to meet teachers. You see, one has the time to do all these things that many, 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 many people don't have. They don't have the time. They're just, you know, trying to get by. Right? Working, 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 taking care of the family, getting water, you know, I mean, it's many, many, many people in this earth, most people, they don't have the time, they don't have the leisure that we have, we should acknowledge how fortunate we are that we have the time, right? Everybody here has the time, right? That's why we're here. If we didn't have the time, we wouldn't be here. So just to acknowledge that is a wonderful thing. And the opportunity, again, it's a whole series, but to realize, wow, not only do I have time, and even if you think I don't have that much time, well, if we really reoriented our priorities, how we spend our time, we all of us would have a lot more time. But wow, I have a lot of time. Some time. Enough time. And I have the opportunity. Right? The Buddha's teachings are still present in this world. They didn't die out. Right? Right? I'm born in a country where they're available. There are many places on this earth where these kind of teachings, I was even heard of them. Teachings that liberate you from suffering. That show you an awakened way to live. Oh. You know, teachings are alive. Teachers are alive. Right in my own country, right in my own town, right in my city, they're available. Practice centers are available. You know, the opportunity is here. You see, time and opportunity have all come together. May not last. Life doesn't last. Our leisure time may not last. Things may happen that all of a sudden we don't have it. Right? So to understand that if you look at your life according to this criteria and you notice, at least at this moment, it's all come together for me. It's like I've been given this precious gift. I don't know how, but somehow it's all come together for me. Right. I got the time, I got the teachers, the teachings, the opportunities to practice, healthy, you know what I mean? It's like it's all here. I got a mind. I'm not delusional. It's a relative. I'm not so delusional that I don't know that I'm not delusional. Right? I'm that healthy. I can, you know, a really sick person is delusional, but they think they're not delusional. They think we're delusional. Worley's healthy enough to know that we are delusional. Say, oh, wow, at least I know that. I have that much insight. Time, opportunity. I don't want to blow it. I don't want to waste it. I don't want to fritter it away. And we have a wonderful society. We have a very wonderful creative society that is endlessly inventing new ways for us to fritter it away. Right? I mean, when I was a kid, you know, you had to go to the movies. Right? Now, you don't have to go to the movies, do you? I mean, you could be entertained from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to bed, couldn't you? Right? It's ubiquitous. It's pernicious. Right? I mean, we can keep ourselves entertained from morning till night. Days, weeks, months, years, a lifetime. We don't want to, in Buddhism we say, if there's one thing we don't want to have is regret. You should never have regret, especially at the end of one's life. To go, wow, all that opportunity, right? I just frittered it away. All those opportunities to love and to be of benefit to people and to develop myself. I just frittered it away. I can't even remember what I frittered it away on. You don't wanna end up like that, do you? So again, we have to reflect deeply in this way. Is that clear? So we're energized. When they say these four mind turnings turn us to Dharma, they're talking about, it's not like it forces us, you know. It's like it makes us enthusiastic. See, enthusiasm, joyful effort. Wow. You know, precious human rare, I got it. God knows how. It's all come together for me. See, most people think it's all come together to them when they get the right relationship, the right job, and live in a nice house. They'll say, what? Oh, it's really, life's good. It's all come together. Now, again, in a worldly way, that's true. But of course, that can all be taken away. This is different. This is different. Impermanence. It's the big one. Every day, gotta come out of denial. Sickness, old age, and death. That's what it's about. That's what it means to have a body. Our mind doesn't like that. Our mind would like not to have a body that gets in the way of it doing what it wants to do. But we got a body. It's fragile. Easily. I mean, look at this. Like, you know, for nothing. And this is nothing, isn't it? Right? Body can't even, you know. I mean, when we go to eat, we have to sanitize our hands, don't we? I mean, that's the environment we live in. Permanence. Everything we have can be taken away. Pleasures only last a moment. Success, fame, all can be taken away. All can be changed. They love you, they hate you. They like you, they dislike you. You're a hero, you're the opposite. Huh? just the way it is. The worldly wins. Why look for your happiness in that? It can't deliver. Is that clear? That's what it's all about. You know, live in it. Yeah, you know, live in it. But understand, that's the way it is. They think you're great. They think you're terrible. One at bat, you hit a home run. The next time you're up, you strike out. That's just the way it is, isn't it? Impermanence. Big one. Combined with the preciousness of human life, the rarity, and that it can be taken away, it's impermanent. And the unsatisfactoriness, we've talked a lot about. It's very important that we're not fooled. You know, why is our mind so worldly? If you look at the content of your mind and what you're thinking about all day and concerned about, what's it concerned with? What? Me and the world and, you know, this one and that one and this one up and down. But, you know, it's like, for what? How many of us, if we're honest, say, yeah, I have a noble mind. All day long, I'm just, you know, if I'm not cultivating mindfulness and presence, I'm really thinking about benefiting people or sending, you know, loving energy into the world. And, you know, in all my encounters, I'm always taking on the suffering of others and always looking for opportunities to benefit. And I mean, how many people can say that? We have, you know, this mind has the capacity for nobility, for love and compassion and understanding and patience and generosity, right? All those things. This is what our minds are capable of. And yet we what? The dregs. We need to wake up. Last but not least, the fourth one is karma, cause and effect, action. How wonderful. I can change. None of it's fixed. That's ultimate bodhicitta. Nothing's solid. Nothing's fixed. Just start developing a whole new repertoire of ways of thinking, ways of being, right? A whole new repertoire, way of speaking, ways of acting. Yeah. Stop reinforcing all the old stuff. Cultivate new. Oh. Cause and effect. That's what this world operates. There's no fate. There's no predestination. There's choice. Dharma says that's the freedom. The freedom that Dharma gives us is we realize I have a choice. Right now, I have a choice. With this thought, I have a choice. With this emotion, I have a choice. With this impulse, I have a choice. I mean, mindfulness gives us the ability to see that we have a choice. Whatever's arising, I have a choice how I want to relate to it. If you're awake, and this is not, you don't have to be a fully aligned Buddha, just have a certain degree of mindfulness, self-awareness, that you're watching, aware of what's arising, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, impulses, choice. How do I want to be in this moment? How do I want to show up in this moment? Is that clear? That's the freedom. And karma is the law that tells us it's possible to change. It reveals to us how I got where I am. Right? Why is this thought arising? Why do I have this tendency? Why do I have this personality characteristic? You know, causes and conditions. Do I want new ones? Create new causes and conditions. It's really that simple. That's where they say it's simple. That's where the teacher said it's simple. But we need, mindfulness. We need self-awareness. We need an introspective capacity that we can see what's arising in our mind. We need a clear path that we want to walk. We need that capacity to see when we're on it and when we're not, correct, recorrect. And it's kind of simple. That's what we're doing all day. No matter what we're doing outside, what it looks like inside, we're just always correcting, recorrecting. But first, we need to, the tools. We need the path. And the path for me is clear, right? I need the mindfulness and the introspective qualities that I'm developing in meditation so I can remember that and observe myself, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, and then it's just a matter of then you practice. Simple? Yeah. So, any questions? Yes.
I'm thinking of the wonderful teaching and the wisdom to take us back to the depths of the four preliminaries we had at the last retreat. But I do have a question, because as students, what's the limit of our translations that we read? And I've read in many places that the first preliminary, the first mind turning, is referred to as precious human birth, and you refer to it as precious human life. Is that just...
Take the meaning, right? Yeah. So again, So the question is: there is something precious about in the Buddhist cosmology of being born a human being. Because in traditional Buddhist cosmology, there are these six realms, right? Realms that have a lot of, very heavy-duty delusion and suffering, and realms that have a lot of pleasure and power, they're upper and lower realms. And the human realm is right in the middle and has characteristics as opposed to the other ones, which are kind of like monocultures. The human realm is a mix. As well as the human realm has this wonderful capacity for self-awareness, introspection. Right? We can step back and we can observe. You see, that's so for that reason, in the six realms, to be born a human being is considered precious. It's a rare opportunity to be in that. Okay, but then what I was talking about today is, and then within the context of that precious human birth or life, to have these opportunities and freedoms is even rarer. This in Buddhism is this is like the one that goes, because the other one is, well, everybody else got it too, right? But to go, wow, not only do I have this capacity of self-reflection, introspection, etc., but there are people around showing me how to use it. You see? It's like having a talent, but no one is noticing. You know what to do with it. Right? It's like Diana, she's a... I like music analogies. It's like, it's like everybody's playing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And you think, oh, that's what it's about to be a musician. Happy birthday, Twinkle, And then all of a sudden somebody comes along and goes, let me show you, what you can do with a cello. And you go, wow. I would have never discovered that on my own, because everybody else was just playing nursery rhymes. You see? So that's precious. It's like that, Alex. So we all, you know, we all have this rare human life, but this, when it comes together with the opportunities and the time, this is much rarer. Is that clear? Good. So it looks like it stopped raining, so we can do some outdoor walking meditation before lunch. We have about 16 minutes. And again, we will use the guided meditation time today after lunch, after the break, and then this evening to really... And again, if you say, "I know it, not this again." Something's missing, all right? We should be doing these reflections, you know, deeply. And we should take them into places that challenge us. Where you don't feel comfortable. I mean, basically what I've said today is enough to turn your life upside down, right? I'm not, you know, I mean, I'm not saying yes to that, but I'm saying, see, you know, let it work its magic. You know, let it unsettle you. You know, the Dharma should challenge us. It should make us uncomfortable, right? At its best, it should pull out the rug from under us. You know, because the Buddhist vision of awakening is, you know, it's like, you know, Bach cello sonatas and Twinkle Twinkle. Like, whew. All the same cello, right? So all the same human life, but very different... There's different ways of pursuing it. So we'll end now.